We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover today.
Busy week.
Starting with a new sheriff in town, although technically not a sheriff.
But. Yes, Murray announced his pick for new chief of police. That would be Kathleen O'Toole. She's the former Boston police commissioner from 2004 to 2006. She also worked with a group that oversaw the Irish National Police, and she also has recent experience in overseeing a Department of Justice reform agreement. Now, the city council will vote on her confirmation on June 30th, but I just want to point out Kathleen O'Toole may have been, she may be the most qualified of the three candidates, but she also doesn't come cheap. The mayor's recommended salary for her is $250,000 a year versus $188,000 per year that was paid to Chief Diaz in 2011. That's approximately a 33% increase.
Although if you go by what they're actually qualified to do, particularly in this context, you can make the case that she's probably worth at least 20 to 30 times what Diaz was, but yes. And it was very interesting. It was very interesting in her, I think it was her first major interview, you know, like press conference with local media. And, you know, she's very self-contained. Of course, she's had a lot of experience with this sort of thing, uses a lot of sort of, you know, corporate jingo and such. I mean, you know, she's essentially the CEO of a large agency, the agency in question this time being the Seattle Police Department. But she has some tics in her mannerisms that are sort of tells, to use the poker terminology. If it were a past era, you know, she'd be just sort of like nervously, casually, like breaking a pencil in half. And when she's talking about the ingrained culture within SPD and sort of the internal politics that are going to need to be navigated in terms of, you know, getting the buy-in of the police guild and the sort of establishment culture within SPD, it's very, very clear that she sees that as her major challenge, and that she's not inclined to be nice about it. I think that's probably what's needed. I mean, we'll see how that actually is navigated. I mean, she's clearly going to get a lot of resistance, as the two interim police chiefs did and as Diaz did and so forth. And, you know, a function of that was a question of how committed they were to reform and how committed McGinn was. And we're really going to see how committed Murray is. But the interesting thing is, this is going to, if O'Toole is not successful, and it's certainly not a quick process, I mean, it's trying to steer a glacier or turn around a cruise ship, it's going to take some time. But if O'Toole is not able to show measurable change in how SPD conducts business and the level of trust that people in the community have for the police department here, that's going to come back on Murray. You know, he really is invested in O'Toole and in this selection and in her success. So hopefully he will give her the political backing, and the council will give her the political backing that she needs to do what needs to be done, and that, in fact, that's what she is there to do. But we'll see. But, you know, it's clear that in terms of being qualified to take out that task, she is. Whether, in fact, it actually happens, we don't know.
And hopefully there won't be any pushback from the police department.
Oh, there will be.
In terms of her being a aggressive woman.
I think the chances of that are slightly, but only slightly, less than the chances that the sun will rise in the east tomorrow morning.
Anyway.
All right. Moving on, a new proposal out this week about potential bus service.
Yeah. Two city council members, Nick Licata and Shama Sawant, talked about their proposal, what they called an amendment to Murray's bus funding proposal, which essentially was the same as the initiative that was just defeated at the polls. Murray's proposal calls for a $60 tab fee, car tab fee, plus a 0.1% sales tax increase. Well, Licata and Sawant said, let's replace that regressive sales tax increase with two other forms of revenue that are less regressive. One would be an increase in the parking tax to 17.5% from 12.5%. The other would be to reinstitute the head tax, or really it was the employee tax, that Seattle charged from 2006 to 2009. During those years, the city of Seattle had businesses within the boundaries of the city pay $25 per employee. in a form of tax called the employee tax, or you know, businesses call it the head tax.
As part of their annual business license.
Yeah. And then, well, it was actually a separate form that mm-hmm. you had to fill out. And I remember because I filled it out for our business, and it was not an onerous tax. We paid way more tax in B&O and L&I and SUTA, and all the other taxes that you have to pay were much more onerous than the employee tax. Considering that Licata and Sawant are saying that the amount of money that they're trying to raise, and if you close the exemptions that were part of the former employee head tax, you could actually businesses could actually end up paying closer to like 17 or 18 bucks per employee rather than 25 bucks. I don't think it's a bad deal. Now, also, we should think about, too, this was the same week that the downtown Tacoma business owners got together and ponied up a bunch of money in order to keep the Tacoma Link rail free so that Sound Transit would not impose any fares on riders that want to ride the Tacoma Link rail, because the downtown Tacoma business owners recognize that free fare means about a million people a year come into the city of Tacoma to shop, to do business via the Link Tacoma Link Light Rail, and they see that as adding value and adding business for them. Now, it would be great if Seattle business owners would recognize the same, that funding transit here in the city of Seattle just makes it a better place to live, a better place to visit, and a better place to shop and spend your money.
It's also a more appropriate form of revenue, in that by assessing taxes based on the number of employees, a fair number of employees, because King County has a population that's more than three times the population of Seattle itself. A lot of the employees that work in Seattle each day do not physically live in Seattle. And so, they certainly use the Metro in-city transit either as part of their commuting or to do errands and different transportation within the city during the day. So it spreads out the burden of funding in-city Metro, to more of the people who actually use the in-city routes, not just in-city residents.
Yeah, it tracks more closely with ridership, given that the majority of people who go particularly into downtown Seattle commute or take transit, versus driving in a single passenger automobile.
And the probably the biggest advantage, of course, to this proposal is that, unlike Murray's proposal, it will not need to go to voters in November. It can be done through councilmanic authority. And the difference in that influences also the other things that will be on the ballot in November, because there's a real danger. At this point, we're looking at four different ballot measures in November, all of which have regressive taxes attached. And if you can eliminate one of those, it increases the chances that others for preschool universal quote unquote preschool, for the $15 an hour measure, etc., that those have a better chance of passing as well.
Plus, businesses have a risk. When you raise the sales tax too high, people start going elsewhere to spend their money. So you would think that this would be a much better option. Anyway, we will see. Now, the council this week is also being very heavily lobbied on the mayor's $15 an hour, well, 15 not yet, proposal. Now, there's two sides that are really doing the heavy lobbying. First is the business interests in the city of Seattle. They actually got the council central staff to put together written wording that they want the council to consider as amendments to the proposal. That wording reflects certain changes, such as instituting a training wage for teenagers, disabled folks, and immigrants, which makes me ask, really, you think disabled folks and immigrants don't have bills to pay?
Wait a minute. So disabled folks who actually have higher basic living expenses, because many of them have medical costs.
Yeah.
I don't track.
Yeah. And paying teenagers a little bit more than, oh, say, $9.72 an hour might actually allow them to save some money for college instead of taking out student loans. Now, another.
Yeah, but banks don't make as much money.
I know. And another, some of the other proposals that business wants, some of the other amendments that business wants to make include a longer phase-in for big wealthy nonprofits like the Gates Foundation. Again, big wealthy nonprofits like the Gates Foundation apparently don't pay at least $15 an hour. It would also exempt employers with less than 10 employees. Really, what is the point there? And they don't want to count individual franchise restaurants as part of one big business, even though the franchisees really do negotiate their fee with the central corporate
office.
And that
is particularly notable because when Murray's proposal originally came out, the whole rap from large business interests, well, this is a compromise. We didn't get everything that we wanted because we gave in and gave a concession on precisely that point.
Exactly.
So they're trying to turn around and get everything
and get
that they wanted.
Yeah. And restaurants also wrote a letter. The Restaurant Association also wrote a letter to the City Council this week. They want to count full-time equivalent employees, which means they want to add up all their part-time employees and divide by 40 hours a week to instead of do a straight head count in terms of the number of employees they have to determine whether or not they're a large or small business. And that just encourages restaurants, you know, if the council adds that amendment, it just encourages the restaurant industry to not give people full-time work, which they've been doing for years in order to avoid paying benefits to their employees. And then they've said, okay, why don't you also make the tip and benefits credit permanent rather than phasing that out? So that's what the business side wants. Now, on the other side is the labor community. They were appalled. They said, how dare the central staff draft wording for the business side of the deal and not also prepare wording for the things that workers might want, including doing away completely with the tip credit, shortening the phase in, especially for big businesses, defining big businesses as 250 employees or more, the same way that the paid sick leave ordinance does, rather than 500 or more, as this current proposal does, and then strengthen enforcement, because there's very, very little enforcement in the proposal as it stands now. Now, they didn't ask for a total doing away with the phase-in for big business, which is what the 15 Now folks want and have in their initiative. And they didn't ask to do away with the benefits credit. And I think that's because labor recognizes that the benefits credit is not going to be as big a wage theft issue as the tip credit will be.
There's also that particularly is coming from Unite Here, the restaurant workers,
yeah,
because they have a contract right now that has extremely generous health care benefits, and they're really worried about losing that if that isn't part of the deal.
Yeah.
And so that has been used to split labor on the labor side of negotiations on this.
All right. Moving on, Washington State Supreme Court
ruling. Yeah, ruling 5-4 that Muslim employees can sue a contractor of Alaska Airlines and SeaTac called Gate Gourmet. Now, you may not have heard of Gate Gourmet. In fact, you probably haven't. But they are a company that provides food to airlines for those rare occasions when airlines actually give you food. But they're primarily talking about first-class customers, right, because who else needs to eat? But the reason that Muslim employees are looking at suing this particular company, it makes its money providing airline food, including ethnic diets. In fact, they do a lot of promoting around the idea that we can accommodate any diet. We can accommodate vegetarian diets. We can accommodate different religions, ethnicities, et cetera, all the special needs that your airline may not. Now, the employees, though, because they work in an area that's on the inside of airport security, they can't bring in food when they are eating, so they can't bring in their lunches, and they don't have a long enough lunch break, thanks to the practices of the employer. It's only 30 minutes that they can actually go out and get anything. So the company actually provides the lunches for them. And as it turns out, they're suing Gate Gourmet because the vegetarian options include animal byproducts, and they're alleging that the company switched from turkey meatballs to beef and pork meatballs for their Muslim employees.
So they're not halal.
No, so that basically you're surreptitiously forcing Muslim workers to violate their religion. Now, it's disgusting to start with.
Also makes you wonder if that vegetarian meal you're getting on the flight has things you're not expecting in it.
Yeah, yeah, your tofu that used to moo, for example. It's really sad. But there's a couple other aspects to this too that are just horrifying. Number one, it really demonstrates very clearly what, different employees at the airport and at SeaTac have been saying for years about the abusive practices, both in terms of wages and wage theft and working conditions of a lot of these subcontractors. It really is that bad, and that's why the proposition in SeaTac last year, I mean, it really came at the end of a long, years-long process of trying to negotiate and trying to draw attention to some of these problems. And then you really wonder in particular with this issue, okay, so you have a bunch of Muslim employees who, are limited in their ability to bring in food because of all of our concern about terrorism in airports. And they've got their security clearances now, and now you're making them really angry about Western capitalism. That just, from a sort of a security standpoint, doesn't seem like a good idea.
Moving on, census.
Yeah, U.S. Census each year releases their list going for the calendar year from July 1 to June 30th of population changes and populations in the country, and issues its list of the 50 largest cities and their growth. And Seattle, for the first time ever, was the fastest growing top 50 city in the country. Between July 2012 and June of 2013. That is to say, of the 50 largest cities by population in the United States, Seattle by percentage added more people than any other cities. In fact, Austin had been the largest for the last couple, and traditionally over the past few years, it's been Sunbelt cities like Austin, like Phoenix and Las Vegas and Dallas and Houston that have a lot of this kind of growth. It's not established, originally industrial cities like cities back east or in the Run Belt or like Seattle. But it was the fastest growing city, 2.8% rather, growth in that year. Not even close. Austin was number two at 2.4, and then Charlotte also at 2.4, and Denver and Washington DC followed. But now 652,000 people in Seattle. Which is quite a bit more than even 10 years ago. There's been 18,000 people just in the last year. And we know, and also that Seattle is growing at twice the rate of the rest of King County, 2.8% to 2.4. And that also went up dramatically. It had been a 25% higher growth rate, July 2011 to June 2012. So it's not just that there's job growth in the region. It is specific to the city of Seattle. And the reason it's specific to City of Seattle is the city's policies around density and around corporate welfare to developers. And that's why you're seeing all this infill in different neighborhoods. And it's not just unusual for Seattle. It's unusual and unprecedented for anywhere in the country how much wealth and how much money is being shoveled to these developers.
People would say that a lot of the growth is because of jobs in the city. And there have been a lot of large employers who were located outside of the city of Seattle who have moved into the city of Seattle. But they have come in because of the availability now of places for their workers to live. The city council this week made some decisions on development regarding small lots and microhousing. First, the microhousing decision added new restrictions, new design review requirements that will make it a lot easier for people who don't want microhousing in their neighborhood to nitpick and sue to prevent microhousing. Also, new minimum size requirements of 285 square feet per unit, indoor unit, in each building. Although I think focusing on the internal space of a micro housing unit is kind of backwards. I think really it's the city's job not to nitpick the design of buildings, other than to say, you know, as long as the building is to code, it's good. They should really focus. The city's job really is to focus on the external size, the number of internal units, and then the pricing of those units. Those are really the things that the city should care about. Micro housing, even though the units are rather small, as long as there's a demand for them, and there will be a demand for them, particularly in places like the University District or in places where you have a lot of young single people, like, for example, Capitol Hill or Lower Queen Anne, the major rental neighborhoods in the city, that they should be allowed. Now, apparently, though, the city is responding mostly, I think, to people who own their single family houses and don't want micro housing anywhere near them. Not necessarily next door, but not even, you know, down at the end of the block where the main street runs by. And I think that's crazy. But, you know, not if you're a city council member. So they passed those this week. They also passed restrictions on lot size to deal with the development of small lots. This is to deal with the fact that a lot of folks are looking back through the historical records of the city and saying, oh, way back in 1890, this had three structures on it, this lot. So therefore it's not one big lot. It's three small lots, and we can now develop it into three small lots with very, very tall, very, very skinny buildings.
Yes, as opposed to 1890 when it was a shanty town.
Yeah, and so the city passed some restrictions this week on developing small lot sizes. It limits the heights on a small lot to 18 feet plus a 5-foot roof peak, or the average of the surrounding wall heights, whichever is taller. That's to try to make development more to scale, so you don't have these really tall 3- and 4-story buildings. You know, 18 feet plus a 5-foot roof peak is really, you know, two generous stories. No new lots can be created by digging into historical records. So if it wasn't a lot before 1957, you can't make it into a new small lot. The depth of a house can't be more than 2 times its width. Again, that prevents those long, skinny, narrow buildings. And they did away with the 100% rule, which would have allowed them to build a new house on any small lot that's 100% of the average lot size on the block, regardless of where that small lot is located, and regardless of whether the other lots on the block had houses or structures on them. That was defeated. And now they have to abide by the 75-80 rule, which means that a small lot must be 75% of the average lot size on the block, and it must have its block face, that part of the lot that faces on the street, must be 80% of the average block face on the block. So it can't be some little structure, some tall, skinny, narrow structure in the backyard of a small single family home.
Yes, although you know, with a lot of different things that come up for review, both with the city's review board and with city council and with upzones, yeah, they often wind up doing variances to a lot of these things. So it doesn't mean that they won't happen. It just means that that's the default.
Yeah.
All right. Portland and Waterrose.
Oh, yeah. Well, on the more regional scale, folks who've been around the Pacific Northwest for a while may remember the slogan, it's the water and a whole lot more. And we certainly had that in Portland this week, where over 1 million people, 670,000 households in the city of Portland and some nearby suburbs are being told to boil their water the last few days, and including today, because of E. coli infections from either animal or human fecal matter in 4 different open-air reservoir sites around the city. Now, you may wonder how something like this can happen, and you also may remember that Seattle had a number of open air reservoirs until they were looted over in the past 10 to 15 years. It makes you wonder, because this sort of thing has not happened historically in the past. What would be different now? Whether the difference is in the water treatment processes or something like this, but it really is once again testimony to how the declining and tighter budgets at the federal and state and local level, and Oregon has had at least as many problems with those as Washington State has had, really cut into things like basic health and infrastructure, so that we're finding problems like this after they infect the drinking water for 1 million people rather than preventing them ahead of time. It's very, very worrisome that we're getting more incidents like this.
All right. Also with Oregon, developments this week with gay marriage.
Yeah, U.S. District Court Judge Michael McShane, the latest to build on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last year and throw out a state-level ban on gay marriage. That's what happened in Oregon this week. Instantly, Oregon became the latest state to allow gay marriage. And a week after Idaho, we talked about that last week, and Pennsylvania also this week after Oregon also allowed gay marriage. You now have a broad swath of states states all up and down the West Coast, the three states on the Pacific Ocean, also Arizona and Utah and Idaho, that all now allow gay marriage. It's by far the largest block in the country. So celebration for Oregon.
Most of New England now.
Yes.
And many Eastern Seaboard states.
Too. Yeah, no. New England is the second largest block. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So good news there for the state of Oregon and for civil rights.
All right. And then bouncing down to Louisiana.
Yeah, the Louisiana state legislature this week passed a bill to require doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. This will mean the closure of about 3 or possibly 4 of the state's 5 abortion clinics. This means that Louisiana now joins Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi in pushing a wide swath of the South back into the dark ages, literally, in terms of women's health care.
And I believe Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
And North Carolina also are on the verge of adding to that.
Their legislatures are also considering it an admitting privileges law. In Louisiana, both Democrats and Republicans voted overwhelmingly for this law, which just, I think, proves that the Deep South is literally another country.
Although, you know, the thing is, most of the remaining clinics in Louisiana are in the New Orleans metropolitan area, which is really not reflective of the rest of the state. So it's again, an urban-rural divide as well, and a racial divide as well.
All right. The USA Freedom Act.
Why don't we pass on that? We can talk about it next week when the Senate's considering it.
All right. Then you have your choice of Fukushima or the Balkans.
Yeah. This week in Fukushima, the contractor there, TEPCO, announced that they were going to start pumping groundwater into the ocean. Apparently, it sits on water table drainage area where water drains from the mountains surrounding the area through that part of the country into the ocean. That's been a major problem for the 3 reactors that have melted down at Fukushima. Yes, 3 reactors melted down at Fukushima, not just one, as many people think. Groundwater routinely drains through that area into the basements of these melted reactors, becomes contaminated, and then TEPCO has to pump it out into storage tanks. Well, they're running out of room to put storage tanks, and the storage tanks are running out of room to hold contaminated water. So they're looking at alternative ways to deal with the groundwater that's consistently seeping in. One of the ways is they're trying now to pump wells and pump water out and around the plant and directly into the ocean. That's what they started doing this week. But as a little sideline to that, the head of the project there at TEPCO warned the company, look, if we don't do something soon, we're going to run out of space. We're going to have to start pumping contaminated water that's sitting in these tanks that are filling up into the ocean because we're losing space and we just cannot continue to do this forever. But until they get the groundwater problem under control, they can't even begin to decommission the damaged reactors. So just to let you know, it's a gift that keeps on giving, plant meltdown.
All right. Events.
Yeah, several this week. And first I want to do a plug, and I don't usually do this for links, and of course it's hard to give out a link on the air, but Ta-Nehisi Coates at The Atlantic, and he's a great writer, particularly on racial issues, but really outdid himself this week with a very long, extensive, well-documented, and really pretty convincing, the most convincing article I have ever seen around the need for and the reasons for reparations, really trying to mainstream that issue, and it's gotten a lot of traction. And beyond reparations,
reparations for slavery,
but drawing a direct link between the genocide and slavery that this country was built on all the way through the racist policies, not just of the Jim Crow era, but today as well, and talking about how that is really an unbroken chain that, again, is a gift that keeps on giving. So I highly recommend that. Go and check it out. It's long, but well worth your time. Also, things that are well worth your time. Today at 11 o'clock, there will be a march against Monsanto. That'll be gathering at Westlake Park downtown at 4th and Pine. Folklife, of course, going on all this week, and SIFF, the San Jose Shell Film Festival, has been going on. There's also, tomorrow and Monday, the Seattle Insurrectionary Film Festival. That'll be free open-air films that'll be happening from 8 to 11 o'clock each night, tomorrow and Monday night at the Black Coffee Co-op on Capitol Hill at 501 East Pine. Wednesday, May 28th, during the day from 11 until 2, Symposium Veterans Fight Against Poverty. That'll be happening at South Seattle Community College at the Clock Tower. Power in South Seattle Community College. And then also on Wednesday the 28th in the evening at Town Hall, Matthew Kronig, one of these, chin-stroking Washington, D.C. policy wonks, he's a professor at Georgetown University, will be in town flogging his book for the case for attacking Iran. Doesn't really have the subtitle of "An Incinerating Lots and Lots of Brown People Because Israel Told It So," but he could. So if you want to offer some feedback to that, that'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.